Hello!
I completely mistimed that.
Hello!
As I mistime most things. I'm Max Davey.
I'm Tess Davey.
Welcome to the ADHD Science Podcast. Yes, we can do some things in unison.
We're so good at this.
We are trained professionals.
You are.
But not at this.
You can tell because this is our third try recording it and we didn't get the intro right.
Yeah, but we didn't even get as far as 10 seconds the second time. So now we're already better.
Who are we interviewing today?
We are going to talk to Emma van Andel from the Netherlands.
Whoa!
This is the longest period we've had from me first approaching somebody, because then she wasn't available for ages, to actually getting the episode out. I think it's a year since I first approached her about doing this episode. So
happy anniversary.
Emma, I'm sorry, Emma, that it's taken so long. It's partly due to technical issues and partly just being busy.
Well, this is a long-awaited episode, isn't it? Because it's on a topic
yes.
that people have been asking us for.
Sleep.
A significant amount. Yes. Sleep.
Sleep. She's got some genuinely mind-blowing stuff to say about sleep that I didn't know before I spoke to Emma.
And I definitely didn't know it.
Yeah, but you haven't been running an ADHD clinic for 14 years.
But I don't know much.
That is your role.
It is.
To be
Finally
the questioner.
Good at.
Oh, lots of things you're good at, Tess.
Good joke from that.
So without further ado, we will plunge you straight into the interview with Emma and see you on the other side.
Hope you can swim.
Hello. Sorry, slight technical hitch. welcome, Emma van Andel. Could you just introduce yourself to the viewers / listeners and we can talk about your work?
Of course. Well, I'm Emma. Thanks very much for inviting me. I'm excited to be on your podcast. I am a researcher in the group of Professor Sandra Kooi at TsyQ in the Netherlands. And we study a lot of things about adult ADHD. And in the past few years, we focused on a lot of sleep work. And we're also moving towards ADHD in women and all other kinds of areas. I myself have a background in biology and cognitive neuroscience. So it was kind of new for me to move into the field of psychiatry. But it's very, it's a very nice place to work because you really know who you are working for and what the questions are that people have for you. And during my studies, I actually got a passion for sleep research and rhythm research, and that's actually how I rolled into the ADHD world, because apparently there's a lot of sleep problems and rhythm problems in
so, so it's been told.
Area. So I've been told, yeah. I didn't know that much about it when I started already about 6 years ago, but I'm all into it now, so that's basically where I come from.
Great, thank you. And I was sort of attracted to your work by a paper about chronotherapy, mm-hmm. and the effect on ADHD.
What is that?
Well, that's what we need to find. That's what we're here to find out, Tess.
That's what we're here to
discover. I may not be the person to ask that question. You have an expert.
That brings us on perfectly. How did you manage it to our first question?
Elegant segue, Tess.
So, in the research, what question were you answering?
We wanted to look at find the best intervention for treating delayed sleep phase syndrome in adults with ADHD, which I think also raises a few other questions.
Yeah.
Because there's some terms in there that might need some explanation. But basically, the background is that 78% of adults with ADHD have a delayed biological rhythm compared to controls of people without ADHD, and it doesn't have to be a problem, but for a lot of people it is, because you can imagine if you are a really late sleeper but you do have to get up early for school, for work, etc., you kind of develop a chronic sleep loss, and that can lead to fatigue, tiredness, problems with emotion regulation, also problems with attention. Everyone knows what it feels like to not sleep well for even just one night. And if that happens over a long period of time, that can lead to all kinds of problems with functioning during the day, and also lead to health problems, especially in the long term. Mm. So that's why it's really important to, find out what's actually happening and how can we help these people to not have these problems. So that's kind of, in short, the background of the whole rhythm part. So since there are so many people with ADHD that have a delayed rhythm and have these problems during the day, we wanted to find out what we could do to improve that. And there were already quite some studies on that particular sleep problem, not in ADHD specifically. And there were two small studies that found that, I'll explain the chronotherapy part in a minute, but that found that if you improve that rhythm, so you advance the rhythm, that could actually lead to a reduction of ADHD symptoms. And there were two small pilot studies that showed that. So the idea of our study was actually to look into that systematically. So we had a randomized clinical trial and we wanted to see, can we actually improve ADHD by targeting the rhythm and the sleep?
So can we just go back? That's a really helpful encapsulation. Can we just go back the delayed sleep phase, mm-hmm. just to check what that means? So
yeah.
Effectively, my understanding is that it means that the natural body clock of a person with ADHD is likely to run later. And that
night
is that. So yeah, essentially night owls, exactly. Yeah.
And me and my brother.
Well, not me.
Not you. No. Oh no, you're an early bird, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm one of the 22%.
You weirdo.
Yeah, it's true.
So's George.
That's George. and
lovely spit down the middle in our family.
And your mum, of course, who's not got ADHD but is a night owl. But there you go.
Crazy.
Same for me.
But so there are people who would run from like midnight to 10, midnight to 8 naturally, or you know, 1 till 9 for their sleep. But the question I have, and actually I probably should know this, but I don't, is would someone with that sleep phase, would they naturally get later and later and later if they were left alone?
Well, in some people that is the case. It depends a bit on how long your internal rhythm is. It's called a circadian rhythm. I think you've heard that term before. It comes from Latin, means approximately one day. And also, so people's internal rhythms are approximately 24 hours long. But for some people, they are a bit shorter than 24. Some people a bit longer than 24. And actually, if you have a rhythm that is longer than 24 hours, so internally, if you were to be left to your own devices and you don't get enough external cues to actually synchronize to the 24-hour light dark cycle, then you can start what you just explained, and it's actually free running. So you can become later and later and later. And you actually see that in a lot of mice studies where they put them in like all dark or, you know, stuff like that. It's not very ethical with people. I think very early studies showed something like that.
People sometimes do it to themselves, and it's the Northern Hemisphere in the winter when they're just on their Xbox constantly. There's a little bit like that experiment.
I feel like
that's tough. No, I haven't even got an Xbox.
Okay, PlayStation, same thing.
Yeah.
Is there anything that can change your rhythm, or is it a set thing that you're kind of born with, or something like that?
My first instinct is to say a bit of both. It's definitely something you're born with. So some people are just later types than others, or earlier types than others. It does shift during your lifetime. So around, I think, 19 years of age is the peak in lateness for everyone. And then you start to become earlier again towards, you know, well, while you age. But it's not a complete twist. So usually it's not like you were born a morning person and suddenly a night. Yeah, you become a bit later during late adolescence, but it doesn't flip completely. So it's quite steady in that regard. But there are definitely things that can influence your rhythm. And that's also, I think, what the chronotherapy part is all about. So, for example, there are some environmental cues that are really important to synchronize your internal rhythm to the external light-dark cycle. And the main one is light, especially daylight, but just light in general. So it's a really strong cue if the sun's up and you know light reaches your eyes and by that your brain, that's actually a really strong cue for your clock. It's daytime, you have to wake up, you have to be active. And at night when the light goes down, that's a cue for your body to say it's nighttime, you should go to bed. So that's basically the strongest cue in the environment that you can have. And you can also use it to influence your rhythm. So for example, if you are a very early type, but you want to stay up later, you keep the lights on and you stay active and you maybe have a meal or something. And that light actually stops your body from going into the night, night phase. But if you are on late type and you want to, get up earlier or be awake in the morning, if you make sure you go outside in the beginning, the early hours of the day or just the first part of the day, that's actually a really strong signal to your body that it should wake up. And so that's actually a sort of natural bright light therapy kind of setting that you can use. And it's also, I think, very important, especially in this day and age. We are always surrounded by screens and lights. And, we look at a phone in bed. And so we are constantly having light in our environment. And I think that's also, it can keep you up and makes you a later type in that sense. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm pretty sure it does.
There are definitely things that you can do to influence your rhythm. And also what time you exercise or when do you have a big meal. They are all cues for your rhythm, for your clock.
And so people with balconies get better sleep because you can go straight outside in the morning. That's what I'm taking away from this. We need a balcony. Can you put a balcony in my room?
We've got a garden.
Oh, why do I can't we need be bothered balcony? To come all the way downstairs in the morning.
That's what the knaves would say in our semi-detached house. We'll just put a balcony in that room which is next to your house.
Just felt like it.
It's not going to work. So what's the nature of the... Is the chronotherapy, therefore, that is in your study, is that involved in basically the manipulation or the kind of giving of these cues? Is that where you're going with this?
Yes. Yeah. So the chronotherapy actually usually consists of melatonin and or bright light therapy. And, I just talked about light. So bright light therapy is often given in the morning to give that really strong signal it's time to wake up. And melatonin is a hormone that is produced naturally in your body towards the end of the day. And it peaks during the night and then it starts to drop down again towards the morning. And when it's low, you can wake up. And when it's high, you feel sleepy and you are ready to go to bed. So melatonin is actually the sort of main hormone involved in the clock in the body. So that's why it can also be used to influence that clock. So basically how that works is if you administer melatonin, so you take melatonin late afternoon, early evening, it actually tells your body to start producing melatonin of its own. So you actually kickstart that production. And when you're a really late type, your melatonin naturally starts with really late. So if you want to become earlier, you can take just a bit of melatonin to kickstart that production and kind of shift your rhythm forward that way. So it's actually a hormone that we naturally have, but you can also use in that way. And bright light therapy works on the other end of sleep, so in the morning, to actually stop that production of melatonin and to wake you up. So those two are actually, they occur naturally in the environment or in your body, and we can use them as therapeutic interventions that way.
Yeah, I've definitely, I know a lot of my friends take melatonin, but I don't think I've ever heard of bright light therapy. I know that there's a type of light therapy that's used for like serotonin production, right?
There's seasonal affective disorder, people often have bright lights.
So that's that's where it, I think, originally is used and where we started our clinic started using it for seasonal depression, and we still use it that way. It can also, it's also effective in non-seasonal depression and in rhythm disorders. It can be used.
So what was the regime that you put in place for people in your study? What did they all get, bright light therapy and melatonin? What happened?
No, we had different groups. So we had three randomized groups, and we had 51 participants, so 17 in each group. Everyone received one session of sleep education. So we talked about what is sleep, what's the rhythm. You know, we gave advice on sleep hygiene, so what is good for healthy sleep, or what shouldn't you do, like drink coffee in the evening, stuff like that. So everyone had that, and then afterwards they received 3 weeks of intervention. And so we had three groups. One of them received placebo, one group received melatonin, and one group melatonin in combination with bright light therapy in the morning. And the idea was, people often ask me, why didn't you have just a bright light therapy group?
Yes. It's an obvious question.
Yeah, it was definitely something that would have been very interesting to see. But this study was designed over 10 years ago already. And back then, melatonin was the main intervention for delayed rhythm. And like we just talked about, bright light therapy was mainly used for seasonal depression. So, and there were these few small studies that showed bright light therapy could actually be effective in ADHD. So we added it as a sort of extra on top of melatonin to see if it would actually add something to the effects of melatonin.
We're on to our second question. So that's what we need to ask.
So
you're surprised by these.
I'm not surprised.
Questions. We ask exactly the same question every time.
Okay. So in your research, what did you find?
Well, quite a lot, actually, because it was quite a large study. But I think it's good to focus on like the rhythm and ADHD, because those were the main outcomes. So we had these three groups that had 3 weeks of placebo, melatonin, or melatonin and bright light therapy. And what we found was that the groups that had melatonin, so both with and without bright light therapy, their rhythms were actually advanced by an hour and a half to 2 hours. So just the biological intervention.
As in advanced meaning they got earlier?
Yeah. So I think a baseline, so before the interventions, it's a marker, we use a marker for rhythm, where we use melatonin onset time. I won't go into too much detail because it's very specific, but that was at 11:45, which was really late. When normally it's around, I think, 9:30 in the general population. And we saw that that actually had moved towards an hour and a half earlier. So off the top of my head, I can't calculate that now. But
So that was a melatonin surge that has moved earlier. So you were measuring that.
Yeah, we were measuring it from saliva. It's actually fairly easy to measure. So we had people chew on sort of cotton swabs every hour between, I think, 8 p.m. and 3 a.m. for one night. So before the intervention and after the intervention, we made them do that. Mm. So it was a quite, you know, they didn't really have a problem with staying up late, but... That way you kind of catch that really first surge in melatonin in this group of people. Yeah, so we saw that melatonin actually started up earlier, which was basically what we wanted to do. The next question was, did it also impact ADHD? Because that was the main thing why we wanted to do it. And interestingly, we saw that if you give people melatonin only, their ADHD symptoms reduced by 14%.
And how would you quantify ADHD symptoms?
We measured the ADHD rating scale. So that's a questionnaire, a validated questionnaire.
Oh, yes.
That we use also in the clinic. To actually kind of see what's happening with after interventions. And in the clinic, we always strive to get 30% reduction that we call remission. So it's not quite in the same league, but it's still 14% is quite a lot.
It's worth having, isn't it?
Definitely. Yeah. And it's just a biological intervention. We didn't give any coaching or ADHD treatment whatsoever. So it was just melatonin intake on its own did that. So that's I think the main thing. And we were really surprised and really happy with that. So yeah, I think the main conclusion was we were able to advance the biological rhythm and reduce ADHD symptoms with melatonin.
Success.
Yeah. I'm sure you said that in your discussion. In your discussion of the paper. You should have done. Was there an additive effect? Was there an extra effect from the light therapy in the morning?
Well, in terms of the rhythm, so melatonin only shifted the rhythm with an hour and a half. And in combination with bright light therapy, it was 2 hours earlier. Statistically, it wasn't a significant difference, but still it looks like there is some additive effect of bright light therapy. But when we looked at the ADHD symptoms, the group that had bright light therapy didn't improve. So that was no. So we were really surprised by that because they did shift forwards 2 hours. So we were really puzzled and we really went into the data to see what was going on and if we could explain that. I think we found a reasonable explanation because we also asked these people how easy was it to adhere to this strict schedule of getting up between 7 and 7:30 a.m. for that bright light therapy every morning. Right. And over half of that group said it was very difficult to do. And they still did it, so we were really happy they were so committed to the study. But yeah, you can imagine, we calculate that actually having to get up that early was about 2.5 hours before they would normally wake up. So you can imagine that's quite a big step all at once to just get up that early for 3 weeks straight. We also looked more into the sleep. And we saw that, unfortunately, people didn't go to bed earlier. So their bodies were ready for sleep earlier in the evening, but it's very difficult to change behaviours.
So is that across all the groups? People didn't actually go to bed earlier?
Yeah, all the groups. So, yeah. And I think it makes sense in a way, I think, because you give people a purely biological intervention. And we did give them advice on sleep hygiene and stuff like that. But we didn't really say you have to do this.
Giving people advice on sleep hygiene makes absolutely no difference.
Exactly.
It's a waste of time.
Exactly. So what we do now...
What I'm saying is just standing there telling you what you should be doing isn't
helping. I'm just
helping.
Saying when I go into certain people's rooms at certain times of night and tell them to go to bed, people don't always listen to me. And this isn't targeted in any way.
Yeah, you're not too bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I think it makes sense that, you know, people didn't really change their behaviours that much. Even though they were really, you know, motivated and committed, it doesn't happen overnight.
But this is what fascinates me so much, and this may become quite technical, so I apologize. But you found two things that really surprised me. Mm-hmm. What time, by the way, did you give the melatonin to the group who were having?
Very good question. I didn't mention that before, but that's very relevant also for answering this question. So in contrast to the bright light therapy timing that was fixed early in the morning, the melatonin intake was individualized. So we measured people's rhythms at baseline, and we actually calculated, based on previous studies, the most effective time of melatonin administration.
Okay, so what is the most effective time for melatonin? I should know.
There is some discussion, but I think the consensus is that if you give it 3 hours before the dim light melatonin onset, so the marker I was talking about earlier, it gives the strongest effect. And I think in normal terms, if you calculate back from your average bedtime, I think it's 5.5 hours before that. that should be the most effective for melatonin. There is some debate on the most effective time, but that's what we use to calculate when to give melatonin.
So that's very interesting, and that's not the conventional teaching in the UK, which is not to say it's wrong, and that's fascinating that that's the approach that's been taken. So therefore, what you're doing when you're measuring the melatonin in the saliva, you're not measuring the dose that you've just given.
No,
you're not measuring the melatonin that you've just given the person.
No, the measurement took place on a different day. So before we started the melatonin administration and like a day afterwards. Yeah, so they weren't taking melatonin when we were measuring their melatonin, if that makes sense.
Sure, but if you're measuring the melatonin, the way that melatonin surge changes, the timing, presumably you're then measuring the melatonin on a day when you've given it.
Now, what we did was we measured the day after the final administration.
Oh, okay. So while they're taking melatonin, you don't measure them. And then at the end of the administration, you then measure them again. And what you've done is essentially
train, the next evening. Yeah.
It's essentially train their system to have this surge earlier in the evening.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that was very clear to me from what she said earlier, but that's just me.
Oh, but it's a good question, because otherwise we would just be measuring what we did.
Otherwise, of course, you're measuring what you actually get.
Yeah, what you did.
I was listening.
The day after the last melatonin intake. Yeah. So then it's the body's own production. And if you measure it just the day after, we think it's still, you know, it's still the same as the weeks before. We also measured it 2 weeks later. So after the end of treatment, and then we actually saw that it had gone back to the way it was before, so it doesn't really hold.
And the obvious question is, has your group or anyone else looked at bright light therapy in isolation since your paper, or is there any work going on at the moment on that?
That's a good question. We are going to do that this winter, actually.
Oh, cool.
It's a small pilot study, so it's not a controlled trial in any way. But like I mentioned, we give bright light therapy for people with seasonal depression, and now also for people with rhythm disturbances or insomnia, for example. So we are going to look into the effects of bright light therapy on its own. I think there must have been some work done since, but I have to admit that I don't have it ready
for... No, I can have a look around. Maybe we can put some stuff up on
there. But I'm sure there is a lot of work currently on sleep and rhythm and ADHD, so
we'll see what's going on with this comes out.
Yeah, exactly.
We will see.
There are some groups working on it, definitely.
That is very interesting. It makes sense that it could be used for people with disrupted sleep cycles, but I guess I just never thought about it. Crazy. Because we learn about that in psychology when we're talking about depression. But I'd never made
the connection.
The connection that, you know, light wakes you up, so why not use this light to wake you up?
Exactly.
I'm a genius, man.
And modest as well.
Yeah,
should we go into a third question then, Tess?
I think we should. That's the second one. What does this mean for people working with ADHD people, like clinicians or, you know, parents of young children?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the main thing is if you are seeing people with ADHD on a regular basis, to always ask about their sleep, their rhythms. And sometimes people don't realize that they are always tired. So you really have to ask, how are you sleeping? How are you functioning? So yeah, I think being aware of the fact that sleep is usually impacted in some way in ADHD is very relevant for people working with people with ADHD. Especially the late rhythm is just so common. Like I said, 78% of adults, and I think 73% of children with ADHD have a delayed rhythm. So, you know, just ask about sleep and be aware of that, I think. And if you do see these types of problems, think about the intervention, think about melatonin, think about bright light therapy, and of course sleep hygiene, but with more, you know, more extensive coaching rather than just saying you have to do this. But really, what we see in the clinic is what really helps people is that we have a sleep group and people actually make their own goals. So really small, achievable goals regarding sleep. And that really helps. And that way you can actually, you know, get control over it and improve your sleep or your rhythm. So I think that's very important to keep in mind if you're working with people with ADHD.
Because the fact that with melatonin you didn't actually find a behavior change is really important implication as well, isn't it? I mean, I know it's not the world, it's a big study, but it's not the world, you know what I mean? It's not absolutely conclusive, but but it does say, it does indicate to me that just giving melatonin, if you're not actually changing behaviors, will change you physiologically, but it won't actually change the amount of sleep you get necessarily.
Yeah, exactly.
Could it change the quality of the sleep that you get?
Oh, yeah.
That's a very good question. We didn't find that, unfortunately. So we didn't see any improvements or anything. But I think if you were to target the behavior too, I think you can actually get really good results. That's what we see in the clinic now, because this is the way we are treating, sleep. And one of my colleagues is actually leading a study called Sleep for Attention by Attention to Sleep. And I think that will, no pun intended, but shed some more light on this matter. Because she actually looks into ADHD treatment, sleep treatment, or a combination. And I think that will show some very promising results in that direction, that you see if you really treat that specifically. Yeah, you can get really strong effects, I think.
There are two things I don't understand. And this is a really interesting, because usually Tess is sort of the layperson, and I'm sort of saying, well, this is this is role reversal. So you don't have to talk like...
I don't know what's going on with my brain today.
Okay, so two things I don't understand. One is how you got an improvement in ADHD symptoms if you didn't have an impact on the amount of sleep.
Mm-hmm. Good question. That's what we didn't understand either.
Yeah.
But we tried to understand, of course. So we also measured sleep with a sort of ActiWatch thing. So I think a lot of people are familiar with the smartwatches. It does something similar, but we get this really like activity pattern, and you can see when people are sleeping, when they are awake, the quality of the sleep. So you can really see what's happening. And we thought perhaps something is still happening in sleep that they may not report, but like I said, nothing really changed in that area. So we couldn't say that the improvement was due to better sleep. So, and that was what we were expecting, you know, you advance your rhythm, you advance your sleep, you sleep longer, you sleep better. So you will have fewer ADHD symptoms maybe, but that wasn't the case. So we are not really sure what's happening, actually.
It's incredibly mysterious anyway, so it's not a surprise that it's foxed us again.
Yeah. there are some very careful indications that maybe people did go to sleep slightly earlier, and that might, so the time of going to sleep might still be kind of the target we should be looking at. But that was all very, very careful and very speculative. And but that might be still, so we don't really know yet. So yeah, it's very interesting to see that just melatonin can actually reduce ADHD symptoms, but we don't know how or why.
And the second question, Tess is putting up too, just in case my brain
for
is not
our
up
audience
to over. Okay, well, holding up your fingers for our audio
in
listeners.
A peace sign.
Okay, fine. The second question is, what's the mechanism by which giving melatonin then promotes the brain to secrete more, the body to secrete more? Because usually when you give a hormone, that actually will suppress the body's natural supply.
Yum, yum, yum.
Very good question. I have to admit, I'm not that familiar with the molecular workings of melatonin. But I think it has to do with the dose we give. I'm not entirely sure about this, but what I do know is that if a lot of people use melatonin as a sleeping aid, so they take it an hour before to go to bed and a rather high dose, and it actually makes you sleepy and you fall asleep and, you know, yes, in the morning
as well. Replacing the body's natural secretion. Yeah. But you're doing something different here then.
Yeah, we're giving a very low dose and a bit earlier in the day. And I think you are then still in that phase that normally occurs in your body too. You know, when it starts to rise, that's actually, it's rising until a certain peak is reached and then it drops again. So I think, like I said, I'm not entirely sure, but I think that's what we are targeting by giving that, you know, if you start early enough and you give that, your body is still, it might think, oh, this is my own melatonin and this is the point at which I have to start making more until I reach that peak and then it goes down again. So don't take my word for it entirely, but...
Just to go back to the implications for clinicians, actually, there's a sort of late large-ish dose, sort of the 2 milligrams mm-hmm. kind of thing that we might use, or 1 milligram, and then you could go early and do a tiny dose that might actually also have an effect, but it's almost two different ways in which the same drug can work, just at different places at different times, which is so amazing and fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. And I think there's still a lot of work being done on all those different approaches. Because usually people use high doses, like 2 milligrams up to 5, I think, are very common. We deliberately chose a low dose because there have been some studies comparing the effects of, for example, 3 or 5 milligrams to 0.3 and 0.5 milligrams, and they saw it was just as effective. But the problem with high dose is that you can actually get a hangover effect. So it can stay in your bodies until, you know, the next morning, next afternoon, which will actually keep you sleepy. So sometimes people think melatonin is working, I'm going to take more, whereas they should be taking less. So it's still a mysterious thing. Like you said, it has different uses. And I'm not that familiar with all the molecular workings or everything that can be done.
But the point is you were giving more like the 0.2, 0.3 dose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the tiny dosing, and that's different to giving high dose, and that's just—I mean—that's mind blowing. That's very, very unusual for medicine. For this is exactly the same molecule to have a completely different—well, not completely different effect, but
not completely different
mechanism depending on the time of day and the dose.
Yeah.
Tess,
I have heard, could be wrong, unreliable source. No offense, Maya. that you cannot buy melatonin over the counter in the UK.
Correct. Well, you can
in other countries.
Yeah, you can in the Netherlands. Yeah. Well, in the Netherlands, it's over the counter. So you can buy it in any pharmacy you like, mm-hmm. up to at least 5 milligrams, maybe even higher doses. I'm not entirely sure. And I think it doesn't have to be a problem because when people use it as a sleeping aid, you know, that's okay. But for people with rhythm disturbances, it's really important to get that timing right.
Yeah.
Timing is more important than the dose, I think. So if you have no idea about its effect on the clock, on the rhythm, you can actually mess it up if you use it incorrectly. So I think I'm always a bit, when I see it in a pharmacy, I'm always a bit like, is that a good idea or not? So there is a debate going on about that.
Because it's so natural to just keep upping and upping the dose. And I have lots of discussions with my patients. We want more dose, we want more dose. I said, well, that doesn't, increasing the dose doesn't actually help.
Sometimes with melatonin, you should go lower sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And we have tried that, but it's just so counterintuitive for people.
True.
And
it requires... But especially if someone reports feeling sleepy all day, I think that's a really strong cue that you may be giving too much.
Yeah.
Because it stays in the body and you don't you kind of keep it high rather than getting a rhythm.
Yeah, and I'm working with kids, so they can't necessarily say.
Do you think that people take too much melatonin, then they're sleepy all day, and then they go, oh, I'm so sleepy, I need more sleep tomorrow, and then they have more melatonin?
Could be.
Could be.
That would be quite funny, I think.
Yeah.
Well, funny in a kind of you're taking an escalating medication that you don't need.
Oh, no, that's not what I meant. That's not what I meant.
I'm sure it happened. I'm not.
Please don't cancel me.
Ruffle.
No.
Tess loves it when I say internet acronyms. It's so cool.
I just can't get enough.
All right. Well, gosh. In answer to your question, Tess, you can get lower. I was going to say you can't get melatonin in medicinal doses over the counter in the UK. Mm-hmm. You can get melatonin in much lower doses in places like Holland & Barrett, other health shops. Health food shops are available, and of course lots of people get stuff off the internet, but actually if you want to do is change your biological rhythm, actually that might be
it might be better.
You might accidentally have a really nice effect. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. But in a very different way to giving the sleep aid 2 milligram, 3 milligram that is in the UK not only not available over the counter, but it's actually extraordinarily difficult to get GPs to prescribe because it's unlicensed and blah blah blah. Anyway, it's annoying. I have to write to the GP every time and do a whole form every time I want them to get this child.
It's very different from
small loan. It's completely uninteresting to anyone who's not actually doing my job. But it's my podcast.
You can do what you want.
You can cut this if you want. okay, so I think we've almost answered this, but let's do our fourth question.
Fourth question. What does this mean for ADHD people themselves?
Yeah, also a very good question. Well, I think a lot of people are, you know, when they hear you talking about this, and I realize that there's always someone saying, oh, that's me, or that's my brother, or that's my mother, or, you know, so a lot of people recognize this. And I think it's really good to, you know, to have that awareness. And what my study in particular means for those people is that I think knowing that you can impact your sleep and your rhythm, and that can also help you with your ADHD, I think is very promising, I can imagine. So you can actually tackle it from both sides. Yeah. So you have the ADHD and you get coaching and you get treatment and etc. But you can also target that sleep or that rhythm specifically. And I haven't found it, but I think my colleagues will report that if you do both, I think that can have a really good effect and that can really help people. Yeah. So hopefully this study or this research has added to that, to the implementation of you know, using melatonin or targeting sleep. I think that can already help people a lot because that's usually one of the big complaints. You know, I'm tired or I can't fall asleep. So if you can improve that, I think it's very good. It's very nice to know.
Excellent. Good. So what about let's do our fifth question. Tess has had a very hard day and I think our brains are starting to work to wear out.
Our extraordinary brains.
Yeah.
That was a nice little in joke.
Beautiful brains.
I've had my drama fund exam today. I'm knackered.
Yeah.
So what's your next question? What are you looking at next?
Oh, so many things that this study actually led to so many new questions that I can't just pick one. But I think what I briefly mentioned in the beginning, that we are working on a couple of big areas like ADHD in women, but that's quite unrelated to what I did in this study. But I think I also mentioned we are doing a light therapy study this winter. And in that, we're also going to look at the timing of bright light therapy. We are going to individualize the timing of bright light therapy, sort of similar to what we did with the melatonin.
Yes.
So that it's not the main question of that study, but we are taking it, you know, we are implementing it. So I think it feels like a bit of a next step in that sense.
Because if you've had a group previously who didn't tolerate bright light therapy very well, then individualization might help that.
Yeah, exactly. And I also mentioned my colleague's work. So she is still, I think she just finished her inclusion of that sleep for attention study that I mentioned. So she looked into ADHD treatment, sleep treatment, or a combination. you know, to study the effects on sleep and ADHD. So she's going to write that up in the next few years, probably.
These things take time, don't they?
Yeah, so it's not my work, but I'm still involved.
What's your research questions when it comes to women and ADHD? What kind of area are you?
We have developed a survey, and it's going to be internationally distributed. It's an online survey. We are still waiting for ethical approval, but hopefully later this year we can, you know, start it up. And it's actually really, really broad, and patient organizations wanted this to happen, and we said, okay, we can do that. We ask a lot about physical health, menstrual cycle, but also the process of getting an ADHD diagnosis, or why you are not able to get one. Yeah. So barriers in that regard, treatment, basically anything we could think of is included in the survey. Sleep is also a part of it. So we really want to, you know, give women with ADHD a voice, because they have been misrepresented for so long, and we really don't know a lot about it. So that's a big thing we are working on. And we are also starting up a few small studies on just mapping the menstrual cycle in ADHD, just to see what it looks like. Is it different from people without ADHD?
Yeah.
Because we know there's a lot of PMS-related complaints, premenstrual worsening of ADHD symptoms. So that's a big area we're also working on.
So neglected. The menstrual cycle.
Never even thought about that.
I've heard a couple of people talk about it, but it's very much in the kind of, we need to look at this, we haven't really looked at this kind of.
Yeah, no, it's very new. And everywhere we go, there are people saying, we really need to do this, and we're glad you're doing it. And, you know, there are groups popping up that start to do it. So that's really good. We also want to do a hormone study to actually look at, you know, the menstrual cycle and the impact of hormones on ADHD. So that's the women in ADHD part of our future.
Yeah,
I'm really excited for it. So, yeah.
Amazing. Have you got any other questions, Tess?
I'm all good here.
You fall into a deep and restful sleep, aren't you?
No, I don't think so.
Because you are a late chronotype.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to go and sit on the internet for 3 hours.
Nice! Well, I should probably do some more of my APQ, but I'm not going to.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, Emma.
Well, thank you for having me.
And do come back if you have other things that you want to talk to us about. Your work with women and ADHD, the menstrual cycle. Absolutely vital stuff. So I'll be really, really excited, assuming we carry on doing this.
I hope so. I'm enjoying it.
Hey. Then yeah, do come back sometime, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
So
there we are. That was Emma and her wonderful, brilliant brain.
Mm-hmm.
What's next for the ADHD Science Podcast?
For the ADHD Science, I'm still thinking about Beyonce, sorry.
Why are you thinking about Beyonce?
She's released some new songs and she's going country. I'm quite excited about
it. Has she done it already, or is she about to do it?
She's released a few songs in anticipation for her new album.
Which is in March?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just focusing on the cool outfits she's been rocking.
I mean, I watched her Super Bowl ad and I couldn't make head nor tail of it. So.
Oh, well, that was the advert. That wasn't her. That was the little company.
It was 2 a.m. and I was quite tired.
I was asleep really at that point, attention. I'm pretty sure. Right, so what's next for the podcast?
Not for Beyonce.
Slightly less, actually quite a lot less important.
Just to be clear.
We're still here. Right, so.
And the next series, we have started recording today.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a mixture of the typical content of interviews with amazing researchers who do just this incredible work. But also we're going to try out a couple of new formats.
And what formats are those?
So one is a Q&A format. So we want you, the listener, to send us questions about what the science says about anything you want to know about ADHD or related conditions, just anything.
Tess will then read those questions to me, and I will try to answer them using
a
combination of having read some stuff up and also my clinical and personal experience of ADHD.
So start thinking of your questions now, and we will tell you how to give them to us on our social media.
Yeah, but broadly speaking, if you go to the ADHD UK website and the section devoted to the podcast, there will certainly be something there where you can enter your questions. And,
eventually.
And there is no silly question.
I will not be mocking any of the questions.
Well, the other thing I was looking at, we very much do good science here, and I go through a lot of papers to select out the ones that I think are going to be most useful to the audience and most interesting, frankly, to me.
Yeah.
So we've got very high quality science, which we actually cover.
In your opinion.
There is quite a lot of bad science or questionable science, shall we say.
Yeah, I'll say controversial science.
Fine. About ADHD. So if you've seen something, a press release or a news story about ADHD, and it sort of seems too good to be true, not quite kosher, I suppose you could say, then do send it to us and we'll have a look at it and see if it is
really bad science. That's our new catchphrase.
I was going to go fad or bad, but
they're
both
so much worse.
They're both bad, so that's
Who knows? Maybe we'll discover some new incredible science while we're there. Maybe the
who knows,
like lemon and salt combination that you rub on your feet will work.
Who knows? Find out later.
Later.
Bye.
Good lord.